everyone. Welcome to If You've Come This Far, where my friend Chris and I actually satisfy our curiosity. It's a little moment we can get together, satisfying our curiosity by having someone we think is interesting come and chat with us. And this is the first time I met this person, but as I said, he's part of the Loggia Mafia. That's what I'm calling it. There'll be more coming. Chris, why don't you tell our listeners who we spoke with in this episode?
The Loggia Mafia. That, yeah, I appreciated that when you said it in sort of a maybe a twisted way. I think
always twisted.
Always, yes. Twisted. Yeah. I think what that tells you is that, like, we're trying to get people on the show who we think are interesting, who are doing good work, who are trying to make the most out of life. The fact that I can count among my friends so many people that fit that bill tells you how lucky I am.
Yes.
I'm lucky to be close friends with Mike Simons. I've known Mike for, we said on the show, we've been in a band together for about 2 decades, a bluegrass band called Hayward.
And Sherm, and, who we spoke with.
And Sherm, yep, Sherm.
Year,
same band with
two
Sherm.
2 years ago? Yeah.
I think about a year and a half, maybe.
Yeah.
And we decided also about a year and a half ago that we should have Mike on the show because of the work Mike does professionally, which has been about 2 decades also of serving youth, particularly Black and brown kids in Chicago via music, via community at sleepaway camps, which are both things that Mike tells us have changed his life, right? That really influenced who he is now. Loves camp.
Yeah.
Maybe I only know the people that did love camp because I'm sure there were kids who went to camp and were like, all right, screw that. I'm not going back again. Because like Mike said, it's not for everybody, but all these guys I know that went to North Star and it really shaped who they are today in a positive way. So, so Mike founded and ran Intonation Music for 15 years. And for the last 3 years, he's been at Camp for All Kids. Not only does the dude love this work, but he believes in it and he has studied it and he understands it, right?
Yeah, like, big time.
He really knows.
Yeah. I mean, he went from one startup, which he did, a nonprofit startup working with kids, to another. He's one of the founders of the Pitchfork Music Festival, if people are familiar with that, which I thought was kind of cool. He kind of talks about it like, oh yeah, whatever. We just kind of whipped this thing. we whipped this thing up. And yes, he was only in it for a few years, but it's still pretty cool.
It was his baby. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And I'll confess to you, and he'll hear this when he listens, but like a lot of those band names that he was referring to from the early days, I had no idea.
Yeah, no clue. Yeah, I got no clue. Well, Andrew Bird, who was at the first show,
Andrew
I know.
Bird, yeah.
But other than that, he's all excited. I'm like, oh, all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like he was always sort of cutting edge and just a music file. Is that a word? You know, like,
yes.
Just a voracious consumer of music. So, anyway, I think the listener will hear that this is a lovely, lovely and super talented person who I adore. Mike Simons.
Right.
Okay. Listen. First things first, Sean, meet Mike Simons, who I call Simo.
Mike, nice to meet you.
It occurred to me, first of all, I went into our version of a CRM to figure out when I first got the idea that we should have you, Mike, on the podcast. And I think it was like June of 2023. Maybe it was at an Intonation event where I was like, I think I talked to Andy Schlinsky and then had this idea. So it's been a while. But what occurs to me as we talk about names is, does everyone, I don't even know this, Mike, does everyone call you Simo, or is that something the band sort of like came up with?
No, that's been a Chicago thing, Chicago crew thing, but it really stuck. I never had a nickname before like that crew. It was probably Nick Marcos.
Oh, of course.
A nickname for everybody. You know,
he does. Well, he's got his own nickname. Sean, this is a buddy of ours with whom we're playing a holiday gig next week. Both Mike and I will probably sit on a few songs. Mike will play more. But he goes by, I don't know if it's his nickname, but he goes by the Hitmaker.
I think I know. I knew that. I think you shared something with me before. Do you, because I did this on a call the other day. I said, okay, what nicknames have you had in your life? So Chris, do you have a nickname right now?
Oh, you know this. I mean, a lot of people call me CeeLo or Loge. Right.
Yeah.
Loge. Right. Yeah.
Loge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. What about you, Sean?
So when I was growing up, it was Emo as a version of Emerson. And then in college, it was Barney Rubble. So just so you know the story. When I was a sophomore in college, I was playing football. I was 235. And so my head and my neck, my head and my shoulders were connected. I had no neck. And so I'm playing defense, and the guy on the other side of the guy in the offense, he's a linebacker, a guy from Tennessee, Doug Petrick. I'm coming for you, Bonnie Rubble. And then it was done and it stuck. So
are you from the East Coast or Boston area? I heard you just said Bonnie.
Yeah.
Bonnie Rubble.
Like my father.
Yeah. Just outside of Northern Mass. Yeah.
Yeah. There it is.
Mm-hmm. It comes out in the early days of this podcast. Simo, he would do the intro and he'd say, "Welcome to If You've Come This Far." Mm-hmm. And it was a dead giveaway. And Sean, just because Mike can't see how tall you are when you talked about being 235, because you can't tell over Zoom, 5'9", 5'9", 235. That's you were a little muscle.
I was a little large. Yeah. So for the listeners, Mike is drinking. So you're drinking out of a coffee cup from a Greek deli, a New York Greek deli.
No, this is ceramic.
Oh, it is ceramic.
Nick is the hit maker is Greek of Greek origin. And, you know, these are from the Greek coffee shops in New York.
Right.
Gave it to me 15 years ago.
Love it.
And I use it all the time. Yeah. It looks like, the real
deal. It does. Yeah. It threw me off. I was going like, wait, did you buy your own sleeve of cups for your house? Yeah. That would be awesome. Right.
I've been, it's a weird thing when we have guests on who we don't know that well, who have written a book or whatever. I feel like my attention is more focused, but I know Mike so well and so much about different parts of your life that I've been struggling. Like, I don't know where to start, but could we, Sean, can you bear with me if I just start by first asking Mike, because we got to start with music. Mike, I haven't seen you for far too long. Can you share what was on your Spotify Wrapped for 2024? Like, what have you been listening to?
Well, the reality is that I share a Spotify account with my daughter, Amelia, who's 10. And so the first four songs in my Wrapped were Taylor Swift, and the fifth one was Olivia Rodrigo.
Yeah.
So, I was a little disappointed with that, but for my own, what came on after that? Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. There's a new album by Nick Cave.
Oh,
I was never a Nick Cave fan, but it's called Wild God, and it's an absolute masterpiece. And I don't know where I've been for all the Nick Cave years, but I listen to that album a lot. And there's like a kind of a companion album, a new record by The Cure, which is like magnificent and beautiful and dark and of the times. Those two plus Beyonce's most recent, which, I was never a Beyonce fan. That'll tie into the intonation discussion. But when this record came out, it blew me away. Just, it's not country, it's her reclaiming the black roots of popular music in a really beautiful and articulate and badass way. So I think those three albums for this year were very much.
Oh, good tips.
Yeah, I was not a Beyonce fan either, and I love Cowboy Carter. I think it's really good. But I've not listened to the Cure album yet, so
it's dark and orchestral, and it's beautiful. It just makes you it fits the times. Yeah. Dark orchestral.
Didn't you guys, I don't know if you guys watched Peaky Blinders, but I have been a Nick Cave fan for a while, but not a huge one. But then, of course, that show used, what's it called? I forget the name of the song, but a dark song, a Nick Cave song. And he's got such an interesting story because I don't know if you guys remember, but his son, both his sons. Do you know this, Sean?
No.
So Nick Cave is from England, and I know that
I
one
knew
of his
that.
sons took his own life by jumping off the cliffs in the south of England.
I don't
What
recall what
happened?
happened to his other son. It might have been an accident or something like that. But and I don't know how many kids. I don't know much about him, but I know he lost two of his kids.
Okay, well, let's move on from that to happier things.
Well, it sounded like Sean's question was actually about Intonation Music Festival, aka Pitchfork. And that was actually kind of the genesis for Intonation Music Workshop.
I think you've been, a musician virtually your whole life. So, you were going to be in, how did you decide to be in music? And then I think that sense sets a stage for, the festival and what the festival's become is, I mean,
And now
pretty
it's
sim-
done. They're
I saw that, right.
So I mean, for me, music has been everything since I was little. I mean, I remember I have a strange kind of photographic memory, audio photographic memory for music, and I've been obsessed with music since I could walk. I remember my like first album was like Sean Cassidy, Da Do Run Run, the 70s, and I knew that by heart. I used to get up before school and listen to a stack of 45s every year when I was in first, second, third grade. And I actually think in retrospect as an adult that my obsession with music was a coping mechanism for ADD, which I was diagnosed with as an adult. But when I think about my life as a child and how music just kind of bolstered me through everything from topic to topic or whatever it was always there to support me, et cetera. And so I was in it from a very, very early age. And
Hey, Mike, can I just stop for a second? Can you say why you decided to go get diagnosed or checked as an adult for ADHD? Why you eventually went in?
I think it was just something that came out of talk therapy at some point. I've been in and out of talk therapy since, I don't know, since I was an adult. And I don't remember at what point I didn't seek to be diagnosed. I think one of my therapists gave me was listening to me and what I was talking about and gave me a checklist for ADHD. And every box got checked. And so I was like, oh wow. And I don't even remember what it was, what the checkoffs were, but I was like, oh, okay. This explains a lot because my attention flies from one thing to another. But if there's a song on, it's there. And that kind of floats me through the whole. It's hard to explain, but
Interesting.
I think there's some credence to it. For me anyway, like I always have music on, kind of carries me through life, and so it very much informed my path along with camp. Those are two things that kind of dovetailed for me professionally and personally.
When did you start
So
playing an instrument?
7th grade, I remember I had a snare drum and took some snare lessons. I'm going on so many tangents, but my very first drum lesson, it was at a music shop, a drum shop, and Beat It came on in the shop, right? And the clerk was like, I swear that's Eddie Van Halen. He's like, nobody else plays like that. That's got to be Eddie Van Halen. And the other clerk was like, are you crazy, man? This is Michael Jackson. Like, this is a pop song. This is not. And that stuck with me all this time, like these two clerks arguing about whether it was in fact Eddie Van. It is Beat It, right?
So I don't even know this.
I think
Oh my
so.
God, you
I
guys go
think
listen to Beat
I
It and listen to the guitar
Oh yeah.
solo.
Oh yeah. It's unbelievable. I'm pretty sure you're right.
Yeah, it's the craziest guitar solo I've ever heard. I don't even understand how he like there's no grounding in the solo. There's nothing traditional about it. It's nuts. But anyway, I started playing drums. I started playing snare to Freeze Frame by the J. Giles Band and thought I was really on to something. And so I became a drummer first, then a bass player, then rhythm instruments. And then when I started Intonation Music Workshop, you know, it was just me, and I can tell you whatever you'd like to hear about that. But I learned how to play piano, guitar, and other instruments by actually teaching it to kids who were learning very simple pop songs, and became a much better musician through teaching. And then, you know, and then there were bands, always bands, high school, college. I was in the, you know, in the, played for the college musicals in the pit.
So we just, one of the things we do every holiday season, and this is December 13th, is we watch Love Actually. And in the movie, you know, the little kid who becomes a drummer says, you know, musicians get chicks. Was that true for you that musicians get chicks?
No, I never had the confidence as a musician. I've always been kind of a utility person, or I like to be the support.
Yep.
I think you're talking about like lead singers and lead guitarists and
mandolin players.
Where the spotlight is, and mandolin players, of course. Man, I don't know. I don't think he was a factor.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Mike, it's fun, especially in light of the demise of Pitchfork, to go back to that history a little bit. How did that idea come up in the first? I know we're going way back, and I don't want to take too much time because I want to get into your work. But how'd the idea come up, et cetera?
It was me and John Singer and a guy named Mike Reed. John and Mike had played in a band together, and John and I were business partners, and we were just lamenting that there was no festival for independent music in Chicago. Like if you wanted independent music in 2004, you would have to go to, you know, like the neighborhood festivals, and that's where you would see it. But then you would also see all the cover bands and everything. And we were like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a space just dedicated to like independent music, emerging music, underground music, et cetera. And so we had the idea of putting on a little festival, and we realized that Pitchfork Media, which I think had been based in Minneapolis, was moving to Chicago at the same time that we had this idea. And we literally just called them up and said, hey, would you guys be interested in curating a lineup for an independent music festival that we're starting?
Were they doing a magazine at the time?
No magazine. It was online reviews. They got a ton of attention that year. And so as their star rose, like this festival became something much, much bigger than we had envisioned. Like we started at a park, started planning at a park. And then we realized it wasn't big enough for what was happening and the quality of artists that we were actually getting to sign up for them. And back then the artists weren't being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, I don't think we paid more than $7,500 for any act. But me speaking personally, I won't speak for the partners that created it, but we had no idea kind of like what we were getting into, and just kind of grew along with it and wound up with like 10,000 people, you know, each of the 3 days or the 2 days at the time. And, you know, it was, I think, the first opportunity for the Pitchfork audience to manifest physically in a space together, which I think was hugely powerful for that audience, like, and to bring their community together into a space with these amazing bands performing one after the other, you know, all day long for so cheap. It was like $25 a day.
Jeez. And who were some of the artists that you had early on that maybe people might know? I mean, I know as it grew, I mean, the names were ridiculous.
Yeah, I think our headliners were Tortoise was a headliner one day. We had Lay Savvy Fav, who was an incredible band. We had Dungen, which was like a Swedish kind of prog act. The Hold Steady, like they're very, very early. Hold Steady. I'm trying to remember more from that original lineup.
Andrew Bird.
Oh my God.
Looking at the list. Andrew Bird was there. Yeah.
You tell me. Yeah. It was an amazing group of musicians, and the spirit was, the Go Team, which is like this band from the UK. They went to the adjacent park and brought a bunch of kids from the pool. Like, pulled the kids out of the pool and were like, you guys want to come on stage and dance with us? And, you know, so there were like 10 neighborhood kids up there in their swimsuits, just like dancing behind the Go Team, which is like very youth centered, like almost like comic book music. It was awesome.
How long did you stay involved?
Well, so then of course, like everything you hear about the music industry settled in. Pitchfork decided like, hey, we're going to do this on our own. Yeah. And so Pitchfork Music Festival was born. We went another year as Intonation and had Vice curate the second year.
Yeah.
And we had, I think, yeah, that was amazing. We had the Boredoms, we had Ghostface, we had our idea for that year was to mash up genres back to back. You know, metal into hip hop, into folk, into we had John Bryan from LA.
Wow. Yeah.
Robert Bob Pollard from Guided by Voices. We just had and Blue Cheer and Rocky Erickson, who hadn't, you know, Rocky Erickson hadn't played outside of Texas in 25 years. Blue Cheer, you know, they wrote Summertime Blues, and I don't know if you know them, but they're like a really heavy band from the 60s. So the first few rows of the second year were all like biker guys who were there just to see those two acts. And that was kind of the magic formula for that festival. Is that like people from different fan bases would come to the show because it was so cheap just to see one or two bands, but then they would also get exposed to all of these other acts and crazy, like the Boredoms are crazy amazing from Japan, you know? And so Chris, you were involved that year, I think, weren't you helping us out?
I think Jen Medina and I worked a booth or something at that one.
Yeah. And after that year, it was kind of like, look, we achieved our goal. The festival audience is being well served.
Yep.
And I went in a different direction.
Yeah.
And that's how Intonation Music Workshop was born, actually through the relationships we made at the festival.
Hey, listeners, I started testing this app called Mental in late 2024, and I've used it literally every day since. Mental is designed specifically for men's mental health, and I can honestly say that I've felt the impact. Handling stress better, building resilience, and feeling stronger really both physically and mentally. So every day I take a cold shower, and I knock out a round of push-ups with coaching from a retired Navy SEAL and a former world heavyweight boxing champion. And while I was skeptical at first, probably even more skeptical than I was about cold showers, I've also been using Mental's AI therapy function. It's not meant to replace real life therapy, but I have found it to be surprisingly valuable. What sets Mental apart is that it's not based on pseudoscience or bro science. It was developed by PhDs in neuroscience and counseling psychology. So it's real science designed to make a real impact. So if you're looking for a way to strengthen your mind and body, I highly recommend giving Mental a try. You can download it using the link in our show notes and get 20% off your annual subscription. I really don't think you'll regret it.
My neighbor, actually, her name was Aura Shoup, way before this, a couple years before, my neighbor saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And she was a lawyer. She ran the community panels for youth at Northwestern Law Center. And community panels for youth was about keeping kids out of the criminal justice system. So our focus was first time youth offenders, whether they broke a window or tagged a building or got into a scuffle, whatever it was, their case would be diverted to our panel and instead of going into the system, because once a child goes into the system, it's very, very hard to get out. And so as a panel member, we would work with the youth to make restitution for whatever they had done and to mentor them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I became a lead panel member over a couple of years, but I noted very strongly that I was having trouble building trust and relationships with the young people I was working with. Here's this white male coming into my life, telling me what to do, whatever. I know he's going to leave. Why should I engage with this person? I don't trust this person, you know? And part of the thing was that all of these small crimes were happening after school. So they between the end of the school day and when a kid goes to bed, that's when they were unsupervised, getting on the wrong track, whatever it was. So my idea was like, hey, let's look at after school programs that would actually engage these young people. And I didn't find much, you know, and I'm a musician and I had just come off Intonation. And I was like, man, why isn't there a music program around the music that kids are listening to? Why isn't there anything for popular music? It was like choir and African drumming and all of these forms of music education where you're taking somebody else's tradition and imposing it on the local community. And so I thought this was a great idea. I went back to Aura with the idea. She hooked me up with Association House of Chicago. They gave me a volunteer slot and a broom closet that was empty. And I brought all my instruments in and I put a flyer up on the board, the bulletin board, and said like, hey, play in your own band, you know, join a band, play in your own band. And I got six kids. And my first question to them was like, what are you listening to? Beyonce. Great. What's your favorite Beyonce song? No one. Great. Let's learn it. All of these songs that the kids wanted are like 2 and 3 chord jams. They had no idea that they had it in them to perform them. No idea that like, that they could be rock stars, you know, in their own community or whatever. It was always something like, why do those people have that?
Yeah.
And I don't. And so I taught them how to play the song. We rotated through the instruments. So all the kids learned all the parts. We performed the song 7 times with each kid on a different instrument each time for their parents in the cafetorium at Association House. And the place was lit. It went. The parents were like, what is going on here? How is my child on stage performing Beyonce?
Oh.
The kids getting all that love from the audience were just, they were just lit up. That's where the Intonation like logo light bulb came from.
Yeah.
It was like you flipped a switch and they were so excited, so engaged, so committed. We had 40 kids, you know, we went from 6 kids to 40 kids between winter and spring terms. And at that point I was like, okay, this needs to happen.
How old were the kids, Mike?
Oh, we had one band that were teenagers and one that were elementary.
Okay.
One was a metal band. The teens were a metal band. They were called More Cowbell, believe it or not. And it just kind of grew from there. We formed a board, and through the festival, we had been introduced to a park district that was looking for a music program, and we started there. And you know, it grew over 15 years, and I led the organization until 2021. We were then in the Chicago public schools, in the park district, at youth development organizations, mostly in Greater Bronzeville. We were able for our kids to play bigger and bigger stages. So, you know, the program would go from the cafetorium to a local venue to the larger venues in Chicago. And then we were invited to play at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame every year. So we would travel to Cleveland and they'd get to perform for everybody visiting the Hall of Fame. And it was magic. And it's still going. We've had the perfect leader, and they're thriving. They're getting their own space. Now, we were always a guest at the Park District. We had offices at 3 different Park Districts and studios at 3 different Park Districts where we are an arts partner in residence. But now they're getting their own storefront space on the south side and thriving. So,
do you know how many kids have been through the program in 15 years? Ballpark?
Oh, I don't know. Probably a couple thousand. It started with 6 and you know, we were in the high hundreds certainly by the time I left.
Any of the kids who have made music their life that you know of?
Yeah, I know of a couple who have. Wyatt Waddell is one of them. He was with us for many years, and he's playing as a, you know, he's working as a musician. And I know of a couple others, but that was never the point of the program, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's yep. It was really about, think of all the benefits of, you know, being on a team. Mm-hmm. Not every kid is a sports kid, you know? And so how else can you be on a team? Well, certainly right. By playing in a band. These guys mm-hmm. had to name their band. They had to choose who's going to play what the banter was going to look like, what their theme was, you know, all kinds of negotiation. And I think the key point for me was like music succeeds where words fail. So mm-hmm. like, when I'm sitting across from a young person in that role as, you know, the panel member, it's very hard to build trust and rapport. If I take that same kid into a room with four or five other kids and say, let's play some music. It all happens through that process. You don't even have to talk about it. It just happens naturally. Music is magic in that way, in terms of healing, in terms of bringing people together, and in terms of transcending barriers that, you know, our society and our culture impose on us. Music just does away with all of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's a really powerful tool in that mm-hmm. way.
I've been to enough Intonation benefits to have seen a number of parents of these kids go on and on about the impact that this program has had on their children. That's certainly a meaningful, at least in my mind, measure of success. I know there are others, but my other question is, I know that there's always more need for this in Chicago, but did anyone in other cities pick up this idea? Is anyone else doing this?
Yeah, there's a great program in Philly called Rock to the Future that is very, very similar. And there are some other programs around the country. We never really had ambitions to scale beyond Chicago because the need here is endless. And we were really focused in the greater Bronzeville area, trying to build community through, because once you have kids playing in bands in communities that are marginalized or where there aren't a lot of sort of like community events to bring people together. What better tool is there to bring people together than to have a group of young people playing hits, making everybody feel great? I think the parents, yeah, they really did see the benefits right away because, you know, think about the goals for youth development. You know, it's around finding your voice, collaborating with other people, taking creative risks, building independence, you know, broadening your horizons, all of those things. When a young person steps out onto a stage in front of an audience and puts themselves out there and gets that wave of amazing energy and adoration back from their parents, their aunts and uncles, their school friends, their teachers and administrators would come, that bolsters them into a different space where it's like, I'm doing this. Right. You know, if I mm-hmm. put the work in and show up, that was the big problem with after school programs was retention.
Yes.
Kids show up, but if they know they're going for something that they care about and that is driven by their culture, they're much more likely to continue to show up and to come back year after year. And just like camp, the long-term benefits of participating year over year, as opposed to a one-off kind of thing, builds a kind of social capital that some of us, those in the white male category or the well-resourced white male category, those supports are kind of built in for us. Mm-hmm. And they're not built in for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I see that those things as critically important. Same with Camp for All Kids. It's the same concept, except going to overnight camp and leveraging that magic. And Chris you went to overnight camp, kid, you know what I'm talking about. Like, there is something magical about what that can bring to your life as a young person, and then as an adult, and then as a professional too.
Mike, you founded Intonation Music. It's called Intonation Music. Not, you took the workshop off the title, right?
You did. Yeah. It was a little cumbersome.
you founded it. You spent 15 years there. I don't think I've ever sat down with you and talked about why you wanted to pursue Camp for All Kids, why the timing was right, et cetera. And I know camp is really important to you, but maybe we could transition if it's okay, Sean.
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question. Why did you leave?
I left for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, as a white male leader, I found increasingly that it was important to me and for the organization that we have leadership that was reflective of the community that we serve. That became very important. And so that was one reason. The other is that I am a founder by mentality. Like I bring a founder's perspective to anything I do, meaning like I have an entrepreneurial spirit that I inherited from my father. I like to build things. I like to pursue ideas and test and refine. But once something is like really up and running, I'm not really a managing
director
as an executive director. Mm-hmm. In the case of Camp for All Kids, you know, I went to camp for 14 summers at North Star Camp, which is like my spiritual home up in Hayward, Wisconsin. Our band is called Hayward.
Right. Yeah.
I was the youngest camper when I got there, and I was program director when I left. And I honestly can say without any hint of hyperbole that like I would have no idea who I am or where I would be professionally had it not been for that experience. But more importantly, the relationships that I built and that social capital. You know, you think you spend 8 weeks a year for 14 years with the same group of people, but you only see them during that time. And once you become a teen and a young adult, that blossoms, and any professional opportunities, et cetera, like so much comes out of that experience. And when I learned about Camp for All Kids, that was in the early 2000s. They had just started in 97 when a parent from South Africa was visiting a girls' camp and just noted a total lack of racial diversity and was like, look, I would like to start a pilot with you on a handshake. And that's what they did. And so I became a board member in the early 2000s because I knew what it meant to me. So if I can pay that forward to those who don't have access or awareness even of what overnight camp is, it's a very specific thing, and especially like 4 and 8 week overnight camp in the Midwest is a very, very specific mm-hmm. culture. And so I also became a school advocate, like a school partner, because I was running Intonation and I had all these school partners, and Camp for All Kids was growing. So I connected them, you know, for kids in the school relationship to recruit campers. So it was already a part of my life. When I stepped down from Intonation and passed the baton to Tanya Howell, who is the current executive director, I was going to take a year off and see what emerged. But one of the camp directors, Andy Schlensky, whispered in my ear, like, Camp for All Kids is looking to grow and is looking for a full-time executive director. Until that time, it had been volunteer-driven, mostly by the alumni of the partner camps. Mm-hmm. These are independent American Camp Association accredited top tier camps in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. And Camp for All Kids had just absorbed another program that was very close to my heart called Four Star Fellowship. And that program is for teens in the city of Chicago and their year-round youth development mentors. So we partner with agencies like Youth Guidance and Champs Mentoring and Embark and a lot of grassroots and citywide youth development organizations. And we leverage that experience of camp to strengthen the bonds. So the way it works is that each organization has mentors already embedded in the schools. And we identify mentors who are interested. They bring their cohort up to camp. They become a cabin group and are joined by a camp counselor. And they spend a week up at camp. Both programs expose kids to an environment that they may have never experienced before. So the wide open natural environment of the North Woods, the wildlife, the water, the beauty of all of that, and activities that they probably never tried before. So water skiing and tubing and canoeing and fishing and archery and rock climbing. Furthermore, they're living together in a cabin with their peers and their trusted adult mentor, who is also, in Four Star Fellowship's case, probably most often not been to camp or to that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So for Four Star Fellowship, you know, when you are a mentor and you get on the back of a tube with a teen and get pulled around the lake behind a motorboat at a high speed, and you've never done that before, and you're both laughing and screaming and didn't think you were going to do it and were not going to get on that tube, but you did, and you come back like totally triumphant, that adds a dimension of the relationship that wasn't there before. And when you get back to school, you're back to the, you know, you snap back into the mentor student thing, but you've got this other thing.
Yep.
You guys have been through this other thing, and our mentors leverage that, and our, you know, our students do too. So, and with the campership program, you know, that's 4 weeks for families. You know, we serve primarily Black and Brown families who have been traditionally excluded from the opportunities in outdoor education, you know, historically. And so we work very hard, both on the camp side and the family side, to define what the experience is before they go up to camp, because it's not part of their lived.
Yeah. Years ago, I worked, you know, helping to run a charter school network here in Chicago. One of our high schools was Ralph Ellison High School, which is probably, I don't know, a mile and a half from the lake. And one of the things that, one of the sort of anecdotes that some of the leadership would talk about is that many of these kids may not have been to the lake, right? Their world is so small. And so where I'm going with this is, A, sleepaway camp is scary for any young person, right? And B, when you're talking about these kids who you're trying to serve, their world is even smaller still. And so there's so much that's foreign about the sleepaway camp in northern Wisconsin or wherever these camps are. Do you have, is it a challenge to sell the idea to these kids and to their parents?
It's a huge challenge. Huge challenge. Because, you know, like you mentioned, it's not part of their history, their tradition. You know, when you talk to, for the campership program, when you talk to a parent about sending their second, third, or fourth grader to where for 4 weeks, you know, and these are independent camps, so they are predominantly white, Jewish, North Shore culture, right? And so parents and families know that their kids are coming into that. The idea is that everybody benefits from going through camp with people of different backgrounds and lived experiences. But building that trust to take the leap takes a lot of time. So we pour a lot of resources into family preparedness, into connecting our new families with our returning families so they know why. Like the first question you often get, whether whoever you are, if you're in the camp, you know, rhythm of things is like, do you not love your kids? Like, why are you sending them away for 4 weeks or 3 weeks? You know? And so really, really laying out what those benefits are, not as a one and done, but also over time, because our program is renewable. Both of our programs are renewable. So the kids can come back for as many years as they want. They can become staff. We support them through that whole thing. And so for Four Star Fellowship, which is focused on teenagers, you see it right away. Like once the kids get on the bus, they are nervous, locked down, hoods up, headphones in, feeling tense. They come out of the bus, and within 12 hours up at camp, They are shoulders relaxed, hoods down, smiles coming out, running free. This is the only environment that many of our kids have experienced where they are not looking over their shoulder at some point, especially for young women and for young men. It started as a young men's program. And, you know, they've told us as such, like, this is a place where I can be a kid. I can be who I am. I don't have to have, you know, they can't afford that here back in Chicago. They can't afford to let their guard down. And so, so yes, absolutely, Chris. I think the word spreads over time from kids who have been and under, because it's a very hard experience to explain. And there are a lot of connotations with the word camp. Is it for little kids? Is it boot camp? Like, are we going to be in tents in the woods with mosquitoes buzzing around? So, but once you've experienced it, then you kind of use the returners as a way to encourage their peers to come. They're not going to take it from me or from you. Or
yeah.
From anybody.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Like with intonation, I think the story is best sold when those kids get up on the stage and actually play music. And then when you hear their mother and their dad get up on stage and say, what's changing this kid? So I'm guessing the same sort of marketing strategy is beneficial for Camp for All Kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really the only effective strategy.
Do you get up to camp while the kids are there? Do you get to see any of this firsthand? I don't even remember.
I do. I attend the week of Four Star Fellowship each year. I'm not obviously not able to do that for the 4 week programs, but we do visit here and there throughout the summer. You know, there's 2 4-week sessions each year, so, and 7 camps. So yeah, we pop in. And it's not to like check up on anybody or anything like that, but just to kind of be a part of what's going on and talk to everybody. And, you know, also I went to one of these camps for 14 years.
So North Star is one of the camps.
North Star is one of the camps. Yeah. There are 3 boys camps and 4 girls camps.
Okay.
That are partnered, well, 5. With one of the 4-star fellowships. So there's really 8 camps involved in both programs. Some of them are in the Eagle River area. Those are Camp Maramita, Camp Chippewa Ranch Camp, Menominee Camp for Boys, Timberlane Camp for Boys. And then across the state on the west side, there's North Star and Birch Trail, a boys and a girls camp, Camp Weehawken, a girls camp also on that side. And then in Minnesota, Camp Comegy, and that's where the whole thing started.
And how many kids a season, Mike, go through the program?
We had about 350 go this year, about 180 for 4-star fellowship, and 150, 160 or so for campership, which is huge growth over the last couple of years. So we're really in a good position to scale up. I mean, we really want to provide the experience to as many kids as possible and raise awareness of, because it's not for everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Right.
You know, a lot of the communities we work in don't even know that it exists or that's a thing, or certainly that it's available to them. Cause you know, it costs a lot to go to summer camp.
Do you have to work hard to fill the spots, or do you have a waiting list of people that want to get in?
We do work hard for the reasons that we mentioned before. You know, we have transitioned from, you know, a volunteer led organization that had one program with a certain family of camps, and would send kind of a similar number of camps to each summer, to scaling up and trying to serve more. That takes time. So not only do you have to build trust with the families, we also, in the school setting, we want to build a camp going culture at the schools that we partner with. That's our model, that we partner with different schools in cities across the Midwest. So it's not only Chicago, it's Milwaukee, it's St. Louis, it's Cleveland, North Chicago. And so that's what I've been working on since I came on, is really trying to put structure and sustainability Intuit systems, et cetera. Yeah. And so hopefully we're growing very quickly. And in the next couple of years, we will be in a place where we have a wait list for both programs.
So you over, you know, the last 20 years or whatever, you've been working with young people across socioeconomic spectrum. I'm curious about now, you know, there's all kinds of conversation about where young people are. You know, a lot of the conversation is about how they're struggling. Curious about what you see across that spectrum. Is there commonalities where you're like, okay, if we did these three things, I mean, we could, I mean, one's probably go to camp, but and play music. But you know, how do we serve kids best today?
Wow, that is a good question. Like the first thing that popped up for me was a benefit that didn't exist 10 years ago, which is one of the biggest benefits of at least of the camp experience right now, which is unplugging from technology.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So at camp, you are not allowed to have a phone.
Right.
And that puts kids in person with each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had a lot of our campership recipients say, like, you know, we've even had a little bit of a challenge connecting with our friends at home because everything is based around the device and the phone and memes and et cetera. But when mm-hmm. we're at camp, we're sitting across from each other, having a conversation, you know, making bracelets together, et cetera. And technology is not, and it made me think, like, I don't actually know of any other context or opportunity where kids can spend 4 weeks free of technology. I yeah. literally can't think of anything except overnight summer camp yeah. where that's a reality. And it is a huge benefit because, to your point, like, what kids need now, we live in a very fast-paced, tech-based, fragmented yeah. Society, and camp kind of brings it all back to people, just yeah. being with other people and learning to live with other people and communicate in a direct way and talk yeah. about things in a deeper way, et cetera. And the camp environment really fosters all of that. And so it gives them something else. It also gives them something that they can count on and look forward to for mm-hmm. next year. So, and that was the case for me as a young person too. Like, no matter what is going on at home, no matter how hard things are at home, I can daydream about summer. I know I'm going back. I know who's going to be there with me. I know what I'm going to be doing. And even the guys in four-star and girls in four-star fellowship who are, it's just a one-week experience. They already take their time off from work. They know we're going that week. Yeah. And they look forward to it all year long, even though it's 1 week. And the American Camp Association did research about this. They did their first impact study a couple of years ago, and they found that the length of the camp experience is not a determining factor. Whether it's 4 weeks or 8 weeks or 1 week, you can get the same benefits year over year for young people, which is powerful.
I think this comment is true and supported by the data, at least some data, that my guess is as they come into camp, giving up their phones, they love the fact because they actually, for their friends back home, they have a good excuse. I'm at camp because that's kind of the world. So I'm curious, is that, do you see that at all?
I see where you're coming from. I think for the younger campers, it's probably hard at first, right? But they get swept up into four teens.
Yeah.
So I think it's a thing where it's like, it's really hard at first, but then once it's been removed, you're like, oh, this is a relief. This is a yeah. burden on my shoulder. Yeah. But all of us, right? We're all trained to hit that refresh all yeah. the time.
Wow.
And I think that's something you do have to get used to. That takes a little bit of time.
Mike, we at New Schools there, we have developed an idea of student growth and student success and life preparedness that we call the expanded definition of student success. So as you would imagine, it's not just all about cognitive growth, right? We need to know how these young people are being prepared to navigate life and relationships and all that context. And you mentioned just now that the impact study, I should know this. So first of all, apologies, but I imagine that both at Intonation and Camp for All Kids, you would at least like to be able to look at some of those other effects of participation in camp and bands, right? Like, do kids show up to school more often? Do they stay out of this of the criminal justice system more often? Like, how well do we know that stuff? Is it something you look at?
It is not currently something that we look at. And I think both organizations have thought about, you know, because there's also the funding community, right? Like, all of this has to be paid for too. And so right. to some degree, you have to show how you measure success for the program. And an academic achievement was never in the mix for either organization. And so we're more focused on, I think, life skills, right? And haven't measured the things that you're talking about, like truancy or academic achievement. I mean, another data point from the ACA study is that high quality overnight camp or outdoor education experiences for kids supports higher academic achievement. So those benefits do carry throughout the year, but they're softer benefits, et cetera. It might be something that we eventually track for four-star fellowship, but our goal with four-star fellowship is not to become another youth development agency. It's to support our partners in their goals. So if that is their goal, then they can measure, you know, between campers and non-campers, et cetera. But that's not really our, I think we're confident enough in both scenarios of the positive benefits of these experiences.
Don't give in, Mike. I mean, you know, Chris is always about the stats, but it's so funny because I just read an op-ed piece the other day where somebody was writing about effective altruism and it's all about the data. It's all about the data. It's all about the data. How about they just go and watch these kids play, you know, play in their band or watch them go running around or on the tube at camp to say, oh, is this effective? How about that? How about that? And I'm all with you because I am. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, the camp's a wonderful experience. What happens when they get home? How are the kids still developing after that wonderful experience? That's part of more about, you know, how they continue to practice and be engaged in those very positive experiences that they have at camp. I'm going the other way on you, which is, oh, we spend so much time on the data and I get it, but you know. So,
it's very hard to measure. It's like, and also Camp for All Kids historically has not done a great job of keeping in touch with our campership alumni as their adults. We are just now welcoming a new board member who was a camper.
Awesome.
Back in around 2000, and her daughter is a camper now. And so connecting with alumni of the program to look back and see, like, okay, what was your pathway from camp? And how do you attribute your current success or where you are in life to what you experience at camp? Because it's very hard to measure.
Yeah.
That's one way of doing it for us, I think, is going to be to talk to alumni as they grow, as they become adults, because they have very powerful things to say about the specifics of what the camp experience provided for them.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit harder in the moment. You know, when they're still young people, still in school, et cetera. It's a long process.
Yeah. And I don't want the data for the sake of the data. I want the data because I strongly hypothesize that there are these effects. Believe it or not, the hour has flown by.
Yes, it has.
Mike, do you have three or four more minutes so we can ask you our three prepared questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Before I do, is there anything else that you would want our listeners to know or about how they might be able to support the cause for Camp for All Kids or Intonation?
Thank you for that. Check out both organizations, intonationmusic.org or campforallkids.org. You know, we are always looking to engage with people in all kinds of ways. It's not just about financial contributions. There are lots of skills and volunteer opportunities that both organizations are. So, you know, if youth development or camp or music education resonates with you, check it out and get in touch.
I love it. All right. Now, speaking of data, it's test time. Let's see if you pass here. The first question, Mike, is what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
My 10-year-old self. I think I would have told myself to be open to trying new things. Mm. Like just put aside your fear and your social anxiety and be open. I think also listen, you know, just have an open heart and an open mind as much as you can. I think that can be hard for a kid with an attention issue, et cetera. Like there's no great rush to get on to the next thing. Like it's okay to be still listening. That's one thing, I guess.
I'm thinking he could have told 10-year-old self, I know you're not going to believe this when you get older, but people aren't going to think Sean Cassidy is cool. But let me tell you, he is definitely cool. Just be okay with that.
That's so true. So true.
I felt like the admission of the Sean Cassidy album, that was a real moment of vulnerability.
I was loving it. I was loving it. Because play that song. Just play it. I mean, play it now. I mean,
I'm going to after. I'm also going to play The Cure and Nick Cave.
It's his cover of To Do Ron Ron. That was the big.
Okay, well.
That's a cover?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, from the 60s.
Like the Ronettes or something. Yeah.
Right.
I love your encyclopedic knowledge of music, Simo. It's amazing. Second question is, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
Say yes. That has been the mantra that I aspire to. I can't say that I achieve it, but for reasons I won't go into, not because I'm not willing, but just from life growing up, et cetera, just like kind of what I said just now, be open, say yes, consider the possibility, you know?
I love that. I am really curious about who do you think you need to say yes to most often?
Need to or want to or
wish you would? Is it Asher?
I think it's a matter of like just being willing to put it out there. Whatever it is. So it's not saying yes in terms of like giving permission to other people. It's more about keeping an open mind, taking the time to consider things and believing that you can achieve great things and not be shut down by everything society tells you and culture tells you. Like forge your path, say yes, consider ideas, try them, even if you're scared, even if you think you're going to fail. Like failure is the greatest indicator of success, right? Like do it. Yeah. Go out there and do it. I tell young people that all the time when they're like, how do I get into this work or whatever? I'm like, go volunteer somewhere. Go out and do something, take action, and things will start to pinball and happen, and opportunities and doors will open up.
You've got me thinking of a lot of things. Okay, final question, because I am going to have to hop in about a few minutes. Mike, this is the deepest of the three. What do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
He said yes. No, really, it is. I consider myself kind of like a conduit, and if I can be remembered as a conduit, I would be happy about that. You know, connecting need to opportunity. that that was what I was about. Not that I made it happen, but that I was open to like bringing resources and needs together. So that's, I guess that's a professionally based answer. But it also is kind of the way I think about moving through the world too.
Yeah. I didn't take it as professional.
No,
at all,
neither did
actually,
I.
When you said it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that if that's how people talk about you, they're probably understating your impact. So for what it's worth.
Thank you. Mm.
Simo, I love you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Mike, nice to meet you. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you guys for the opportunity and your patience.
Love it. I'll see you. I think I'll see you next week with the Hitmaker.
Yeah,
guys, go for it. Make some music.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.